Welcome to Songcraft, Spotlight on Songwriters. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. Songcraft brings you conversations with and about the men and women who've put pen to paper, hands to keyboards, and fingers to strings to create lyrics and music that stand the test of time. You probably know the names, and you definitely know the songs. We bring you the stories.
Keep up with us via Facebook, Twitter, or our website by searching for one word, Songcraft Show. While Songcraft is always free, if you believe in our mission of preserving and presenting these important conversations, we invite you to visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/songcraftshow. There you can help support us with a voluntary monthly pledge that will also give you access to bonus content and other extras as our way of saying thanks for your continued support.
You're listening to Strawberry Wine, co-written by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Matresa Berg. Later in the show, the three-time Grammy nominee, Nashville Songwriters Hall of Famer, and ACM Poets Award recipient will join us to talk about the pile of hit songs she's written, including Wrong Side of Memphis, You and Tequila, and many others, and we'll also dig into her own career as an unclassifiable but utterly classy singer-songwriter.
But first, in part one, Scott and I will talk about certain artists that can hardly be imagined apart from the contributions of their indispensable musical compadres.
Part one.
So this is going to sound like I'm starting a comedy bit, but it's not. This is just the real story. I'm talking to my wife the other day.
Right.
And I saw that Ozzy Osbourne was coming to play in LA in October. And I said, hey, do you want to go? And she said, well, is Zach Wilde going to be there? Guitarist Zach
right.
Wilde.
Right.
And I was like, I don't know. Like, I haven't been keeping up with, you know, all the ins and outs of Ozzy's touring band.
Right.
But she's like, if Zach Wilde's not playing, I don't want to go.
Wow.
Which I thought, wow. That says a lot about Zach Wilde and his yeah. stage presence and contributions to the show. I personally would go see Ozzy either way.
Yeah.
But it's funny because there have been several times throughout Ozzy's career when you've said, well, Ozzy's not Ozzy without Randy Rhoads.
Right, right.
Or back in the Black Sabbath days, without, you know, Geezer and Tommy.
Right.
And here it is now with Zach Wilde. And it got me thinking, there are certain artists that, especially their diehard fans,
right.
they're like, oh, I'm not going to see that artist unless so-and-so is in the band, or unless it's this incarnation of the band, you know.
Right, right, yeah.
And there are a few of those that really, really stick out to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to throw out one right away.
Okay.
I got to see Bruce Springsteen with the E Street Band.
Right.
And to be able to go to like a really diehard Bruce fan and say, well, I saw him with the E Street Band, then they're kind of going, oh, well, you saw the real thing then.
Right.
But if you saw him maybe on the Lucky Town tour.
Right.
Or the Human Touch era.
Or the Seeger Sessions.
Which I saw as well, which was
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Both shows were awesome. But a lot of people out there feel like, well, if you didn't see Little Steven out there
right,
with the do-rag and the whole thing, then you didn't really see Bruce.
Yeah, yeah, I hear that. As a guy who's actually seen the E Street Band on multiple occasions, I have to say the first time I ever saw Bruce was acoustic, just him and an acoustic guitar.
Wow.
And that did not deter me because, I feel like Bruce, like, yeah, sure, the E Street Band is great, but Bruce is that's the core, you know,
right.
It's the songs, it's the voice.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be much more likely to see Bruce without the E Street Band than to go see the E Street Band without Bruce.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, I think Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers kind of fell into that same category
mm-hmm.
where, you know, there was a period of time, like around the Full Moon Fever era, where Tom was kind of doing his solo thing and
right.
not surrounding himself with the Heartbreakers as much, although Mike Campbell was kind of
right.
always
Which,
around.
Let's be honest,
yeah.
that's you can have Tom Petty with anybody, but you need Mike Campbell.
Yeah.
He's totally. You got to have him.
Well, see, and that's really interesting because Tom is, you know, just with his voice, with his persona, with the songs he writes, a towering figure
right.
in music. And yet, to the people that you know, live really closely to his music, Mike Campbell's got to be there.
Right, right. And it's funny how you like how where the dividing line is, because I would go see the Rolling Stones,
no.
but I would never go see Mick Jagger singing the songs of the Rolling Stones.
Right. Yeah, you got to have Keith there. You got to have Charlie Watts there.
Yeah, it's just
now,
not the same.
I've gone to see Eddie Vedder solo, and it was a great experience.
Right.
Part of it, I think, is because he doesn't try to do like a rock band thing.
Right.
He's
yeah.
sitting out on a stool with a ukulele. And I'm like,
right.
okay, well, that's different. That's a whole different
right.
kind of thing.
That's how I know you're a huge Pearl Jam fan, by the way.
If I'll go see the lead singer sit down with
a whole show of a guy with a ukulele.
But see, on the flip side, this is what's weird to me, is that Fleetwood Mac will routinely tour without mainstay members in the lineup. You know, they've done it without Christine McVie.
Yeah.
Now they're going out without Lindsey Buckingham.
And I wouldn't see him without Lindsey Buckingham.
I wouldn't either. I did go see him without Christine McVie.
I did too. And the only reason I did is because I was led to believe that Christine McVie would never rejoin the band. So I'm like, all right, well, this is as close as I'm going to get. And then she did. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to pay for another $150 ticket.
But don't you kind of think that, like, Lindsey and Stevie, like, if you see that, you're definitely seeing kind of one color of Fleetwood Mac.
Yes, but had I believed that Christine might come back into the fold, I would have not gone to see him when I did. Mm. I would have waited until I could have seen, like, the whole classic lineup. Of course, that band's had, like, 15 different lineups.
Totally.
So, but, yeah.
Yeah, if Peter Green's not there, I'm not going. meanwhile, of course, I went to see Brian Wilson play Pet Sounds without the Beach Boys.
Right.
And I was totally fine. Al Jardine was there. I want to give credit where credit's due. But it wasn't announced. It wasn't why I went.
Yeah. And I have no interest in going to see the Beach Boys without Brian Wilson.
No, not going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, well, how about this? The Eagles are traveling now, obviously without Glenn Frey.
Yeah.
No longer with us.
Not interested.
But what if I told you this? What if I said Don Henley, Joe Walsh, Timothy B. Schmidt, and Vince Gill are going to get together and play some Eagles songs?
Yeah, I'd be interested in that.
Okay. See, that's what it is.
Right.
And it's the power of branding, I suppose. It's the reason that Kiss can go out with four guys in makeup and two of them are like 25 right. and two of them are Paul and Gene.
Right. Yeah, but you got to have Paul and Gene.
Yep.
If you know Paul and Gene, no Kiss. You know, and being the big classic country music fan that I am, Buck Owens is one where he had Don Rich, who was his lead guitar player, and they were really kind of a musical partnership after Don Rich died in 1974. Buck Owens like kind of lost his mojo and wasn't the same, you know. So even though he's the guy, he's the front, he's the face.
Yeah.
Some musicians like kind of aren't reaching their full potential without their you know, whoever their side person is.
Of course, me having sort of found out about Buck Owens from Hee Haw, I'm like, I don't want to see him without Roy Clark. Grandpa Jones isn't there. Right. I ain't going to that. I'm not going to that.
It's a good policy in general. No grandpa, no show. Yeah. There's a funny, Chris Rock's most recent stand-up thing. He's talking about like a marriage is a partnership, you know, and you got to maintain, everybody has to kind of like know their part. And sometimes you're the lead singer, sometimes you play the tambourine and it switches off. And when the marriage partnership, you got to know like when it's your time to play the tambourine, when it's your time to sing lead and all this stuff. And he's like, you know, I don't know what Oates does, but Hall's never had a hit without him.
That's true. That's true. And I went to see Hall & Oates at the Staples Center.
Yeah.
I don't think Daryl Hall at the Staples Center would have happened.
No.
I think it would have been Daryl Hall at the Troubadour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hall & Oates at the Staples Center.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And I wouldn't go see a Daryl Hall show, but I would go see a Hall & Oates show. Absolutely.
You know, to the point you just made earlier, if somebody were either to go see your wife or to go see you, which one's the draw?
Well, she's better looking, so okay. I would think that would be the one for sure.
Wise man.
Part 2.
Matresa Berg landed her first number one country single as a songwriter when she was just 18 years old. She went on to earn well over a dozen more top 10 hits by artists such as Patti Loveless, who found success with I'm That Kind of Girl and You Can Feel Better, Trisha Yearwood, who scored with Wrong Side of Memphis, X's and O's, and Everybody Knows, and Dina Carter, who hit number one with We Danced Anyway and Strawberry Wine, the latter earning the award for CMA Song of the Year. Other hits from the Matresa Berg songbook include Reba McEntire's Last One to Know, Martina McBride's Wild Angels, the Dixie Chicks' If I Fall, You're Going Down With Me, and Kenny Chesney and Grace Potter's hit duet, You and Tequila. The list of others who've recorded Matresa's songs includes Linda Ronstadt, Dusty Springfield, Emmylou Harris, Loretta Lynn, Ray Price, and Randy Travis. In addition to her success on the mainstream country charts, Berg is what AllMusic calls an unclassifiable but utterly classy singer-songwriter and recording artist. Her debut album, Lying to the Moon, spawned two top 40 singles and earned her an ACM nomination for Top New Female Vocalist. Her Sunday Morning to Saturday Night album was named one of the top 10 albums of the year by Time Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, and USA Today, while The Dreaming Fields has earned rave reviews from Rolling Stone, NPR, The New York Times, and others. Berg has received 3 Grammy nominations for Best Country Song, was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, and received the prestigious ACM Poets Award in 2017. Matresa, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, great to speak with you. And, you know, Paul and I both grew up in Nashville, and it's such a magnet for, you know, everyone who grew up somewhere else but has this kind of romantic outsider perspective of you know, moving there and making it as a songwriter. You're one of the rare few songwriters who actually grew up there. And I know your mom was an aspiring writer. And I actually just recently learned that your father was Dave Kirby, who wrote hit songs like Is Anybody Going to San Antone by Charlie Pride and Memories to Burn for Gene Watson. So you kind of grew up with this realistic view of the life of a working songwriter. Talk about the perspective you had on songwriting as a profession when you were growing up, even, you know, when you were just a young kid.
Well, Dave Kirby was my stepfather. I was 16 years old when he married my mother.
Okay.
My mother was a backup singer. My aunt was a prominent backup singer, and my uncle Jim played steel guitar for Mel Tillis. So, you know, and my mom had aspired to be a songwriter as well. So a lot of my mom's friends were songwriters.
Yeah.
I grew up around future Hall of Famers.
Wow.
Red Lane, I was in love with Red Lane. I wanted to marry him when I was four.
Wasn't his house like a converted airplane?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I want to marry that guy too. Right. That's awesome.
No, he was just magic. He was pure magic. And he would sit at the kitchen table and put melodies to nursery rhymes and sing with me.
Wow.
And he was just the bee's knees for me.
Yeah.
And Sonny Throckmorton, it was kind of like the family business.
Sure.
When Mom and my aunt didn't find a babysitter for me, they used to take me to recording sessions, and I grew up sitting on that Naga hide couch in front of the control.
Right.
Looking out that plexiglass, you know.
Getting a little secondhand smoke.
Oh, God, yes.
Well, I mean, you obviously got your exposure to the business early, and you got started early. I mean, you had your very first charting single as a writer in 1982, also became your first number one hit with the T.G. Shepherd and Karen Brooks duet, Faking Love.
Faking love. Faking love. Only temporary lovers as we lie here to each other. We're just faking love.
Now, you were 18 years old at the time. And speaking of future Hall of Famers, you wrote that song with Bobby Braddock, who was 42 years old and already a Hall of Famer at that point. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how intimidating was that experience?
It was not.
And really?
If you knew Bobby, you would understand. Do you know Bobby?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, we interviewed Bobby. He was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you probably grew up knowing him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been around him,
and
so.
You know how humble he is.
Right.
And he just, I was running around with a bunch of Belmont kids. There was a place called Close Quarters. It was a bar, a restaurant, and there was a courtyard outside that was kind of the hang at the time for Music Row.
Right.
And we stopped Bobby Braddock.
Wow.
He stopped the Levener today. It was at its peak.
Right.
And we were obsessed with him. So whenever he was there, we would always send drinks over to him.
Nice.
And then one day he invited us all over because he's so sweet.
Wait, you're not even old enough to order alcohol at that point, right? I mean, you said just card him.
They were pretty loose.
Take it to him and card him.
Right. That's amazing.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't what it's like now. And we got to know him that way. Mm. And one night he was having this party and we crashed it. And he had this long house, and on the other side of the house was his music room. And I snuck into his music room and started playing, and I had this idea, and I was just kind of picking around on it, and he shows up in the door, and he says, "What's that?" And I said, "I don't know, it's just this little play on words thing I was working on," and we wrote it really fast.
Wow.
He sat down, he said, "I really like that."
At the party.
I finished it. At the party.
Wow.
And I didn't even think of any, you know, I didn't really think about it after that. And then he wanted to demo it, and I was like, okay, I'll demo it. And I was already writing some with Mom and Dave Kirby.
Right.
So you know, I'd had some experience in studio.
Yeah.
So we demoed it, and it was weird. It was like just a few months later, it was a single.
Wow,
that's amazing.
And then it went to number one, and it was mind-blowing. But if you write a song with Bobby Braddock, and he just wrote, "You Stop Loving Her Today,"
that's how you figure it's going to go.
Right, right.
Meanwhile, somebody's leaving that party going, "Man, Bobby Braddock's a great writer, but not much of a host. Like, he just disappeared for a couple hours. I never got to say goodbye to him." Well, it was 4 years later before you had another chart hit as a songwriter, but it was worth the wait because you landed another number one hit with Reba McEntire's recording of "The Last One to Know." I want to know about that four-year period between those number ones, you know, where you've had incredible success, but you're not sure it's going to happen again.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, people weren't really taking me very seriously. First of all, I'm 18 years old.
Right.
And they also thought that Bobby was, that I was sleeping with Bobby.
Right.
You know, nobody said that, but that I got that feeling.
Yeah. Mm.
And so I just, you know, I kind of flailed around for a little while, and I met this band. This band was here looking for a singer in Louisiana. They were from Louisiana. And so I joined the band, and I left town. And there was a boy involved.
Right.
And I hung out there, you know, for a year, a little over a year. And then I came back up here, and he came up here too. And we started writing songs for Merit Music, kind of song by song. And that's where The Last One to Know landed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the boy and I broke up, and I moved in with a woman named Jane Mariash, who was a writer that came in from New York, and so we were roommates. And one night she was cooking dinner, and I was banging on the piano, and we wrote "Last One to Know."
Huh.
And also a part of that time was my mother got really sick. And she died of lymphoma when I was 20. And that was kind of a lost year as well, because it's all consuming, you know, especially someone so young, you know.
Yeah, for
sure. It's a difficult time.
Yeah. Well, you landed a couple more charting singles in the 1980s, but in the 1990s, we begin to see Matresa Berg, the artist, with your debut album on RCA, "Lying to the Moon," and you landed a couple of top 40 singles from that record. My personal favorite song is actually the title track, which was later recorded by Trisha Yearwood, which was not one of the singles. But talk about the making of that album and how you envisioned your career trajectory at that point in terms of the balance of sort of being a songwriter for other artists versus a singer-songwriter doing your own thing?
You know, I really didn't think a lot about being a recording artist.
Hmm.
You know, and I've, you know, Bobby said I should try, and I said, no, I don't think, you know, I'm ready for anything like that. And,
yeah.
And Joe Bonney heard a demo of mine, and took me to lunch and asked me, you know, was I thinking of a recording career? And I told him, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm not ready.
Hmm.
And I just kept putting it off because my heart was not totally in it.
Right.
I just love writing songs.
Hmm.
You know, and if I could make records and just stay home,
right,
that would be awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not like that. So, you know, everybody was like, you're crazy. Joe Galani, he was the hottest record guy in town at that time.
Right.
You know, just everything he touched turned to gold till he got to me. But, you know, everybody said I was crazy to turn it down. So I said yes, and I recorded this record, and he was very generous. He let me pick my producer, and you know, I got to record the songs I wanted, and you know, it did okay.
Yeah,
I was very busy. I was gone all the time, and I was exhausted, and I had terrible stage fright. So that was emotionally exhausting too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I made the second record, and it was there was some things that went on behind the scenes with the producer choice that it just didn't work out.
Right.
It was not a good situation. So, you know, we canned the record, and Joe then went to New York and brought me up to the New York roster, and it just kept bouncing around until I just finally said, you know, I need to chill on this.
Yeah.
I can't do this.
Yeah.
And so I got married to Jeff Hanna.
Right.
And I started writing a ton. And I was still doing some gigs, but, you know, just taking a break.
Yeah.
And so I wrote all these songs and was just having a blast demoing them all. And in the meantime, all the girls that were making records, the new girls,
right,
had my record.
Yeah.
Huh.
Which is something I found out much later on.
Hmm.
So I guess it was a good demo.
Right.
Expensive for somebody.
It was a very expensive demo.
Right.
And, you know, and really there were no hits off of it, but it at least they knew who I was.
Yeah.
So they listened to my song.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
I want to just do this kind of like mini segment of the show right here. I'm going to call this the Fives Club, because your highest charting single each year in 91, 92, and 93 hit number 5 on the Billboard Country Singles chart. So I'm just going to name each of these 3 songs, and I'd love to get just sort of a quick kind of off the top of your head response to each of the songs. And it could kind of be anything, rather a memory associated with writing it or something about how it was received or the way that, you know, some fan told you it meant something to them. But just would love to kind of get your gut reaction to, here's what pops into my mind with that song. So the first one would be I'm That Kind of Girl by Patti Loveless.
I don't know. I was just, that's really young. I was writing this, my friend Ronnie Sam said, it was kind of just a clever idea.
Right.
And it also, I was just romantically frustrated.
Right.
Because, you know, they either went one type or the other. And I don't know. I felt like maybe because back then there weren't a ton of female songwriters.
Right.
And so all my friends were guys.
Right.
Mm. And I think they just all felt that way about me, you know?
Right.
And maybe I was just thinking, well, maybe that's what I'm just putting off everywhere.
Huh. Interesting.
You know, I'm putting that out there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, another one, one of my favorites, Wrong Side of Memphis by Trisha Yearwood.
That was a fun one. And that was the first song I wrote with Gary Harrison, who is probably one of my more consistent co-writers.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite, of course. And we were at a publishing company. My song quoter from Warner Chappell left, and I went with him. And he started the Patrick Joseph Music.
Right.
And he signed me and Gary Harrison and Jim Fotoglow and Vince Melamed. And I think that was at a time, maybe Kenny Menzies was there.
Yeah.
And we were just, you know, shooting the shit in the kitchen, drinking coffee, and just talking about where we were from.
Right.
And Gary said, "Well, I'm from the wrong side of Memphis." And I pointed at him and I said, "Boom!"
Right. The title alarm went off. That's incredible.
And so, I mean, literally, we got together with that song in like 20 minutes.
Wow. So the third one would be "Hey Cinderella" by Susie Boggess.
August, who was one of my favorite artists, she was writing for a record, and she just sat down with me and Gary Harrison, and I don't know, she's one of my best friends.
Mm.
We became, like, super close over the years.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of it. And I kind of knew that it was special when she came up with the line, "Does the shoe fit you now?"
Hmm.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, girl, you're going to make something of this.
Right.
All right, so that was the Five Club, and I don't want to be outdone, so I'm going to do my own thing with the Ones Club. And these are going to be three Billboard chart-topping hits from 1994 and 1995. So same thing. I'm going to throw out the title and just get whatever pops into your head when you hear X's and O's by Trisha Yearwood. She used to tie her hair up in ribbons and bows, sign her letters with X's and O's. Got a picture of her mama in heels and pearls. She's trying to make it in her daddy's world. She's an American girl. An American girl.
Yeah, I wrote that song with Alice Randall. She's actually a professor now over at Vanderbilt. But she writes, and she wrote with Steve Earle some, and we kind of came up together from, you know, just showing up as kids in the scene. And she had written a television pilot, and they needed a theme song, like a Mary Tyler Moore thing, you know. And that's what we did. We wrote a song kind of in the Mary Tyler Moore vein, you know, woman power.
Yeah.
and the show flopped.
Yeah.
But Tony Brown and Trisha heard it and cut it. I was really surprised, actually.
Yeah.
I really didn't think about that song after the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And boom.
Well,
there you go.
Let's try Wild Angels by Martina McBride. Must have been a
I was in a place of big time gratitude at that point. Me and Jeff had gotten married, and I'd just been through so much in the past, and he'd just been through so much in the past. We were also, the first couple of years of our relationship were kind of passing each other in airports.
Yeah.
And, that just came from a place of pure gratitude, just for, feeling blessed.
Yeah.
All right, rounding out my club here is You Can Feel Bad by Patti Loveless.
That was written with Tim Krickle, the late, great Tim Krickle. He was in my band for a little while, and we started writing songs. I forgot what the original song was, but You Can Feel Bad If It Makes You Feel Better showed up in the bridge. And this was the only time I've ever done this. I said, Tim, this is the song. We got to rewrite this. This is the song.
Right.
This is the chorus. So that's how that happened.
Well, somehow in the midst of that huge flurry of activity in the mid-1990s, we talked about your RCA deal, but that was when the third album, I guess, the second one to be released, but the third one you recorded, The Speed of Grace, came out. And that was really more of a pop record. And, as someone who was still kind of doing the artist thing with a major label at the same time that you're having these massive, hits with other artists, how do you kind of navigate that balance between, as a writer, okay, this song is just for me, versus, all right, this one's going to be for someone else? Do you sort of actively approach the process differently, or is you just sort of do your thing and let the chips fall?
Yeah, it's kind of like, do your thing and let the chips fall.
Hmm.
I wrote a lot of my bigger songs after that pop record, because the pop record was really good for me because it let me know what I wasn't.
Yeah.
Mm. That was my breaking point. I'm like, this is not me.
Hmm.
What am I doing?
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote all those other songs. And I was literally looking for a deal with those songs, and Tony Brown wanted to sign me, but I guess there were a couple of people at MCA that didn't.
Yeah.
And I just told Pat to pitch everything, because I just at that point I was kind of I was just really frustrated with it all, and I was tired of the whole grind.
Yeah.
The country star grind.
Right.
I'm not. It ain't for sissies.
Yeah.
It's you have to have a certain constitution.
Yeah.
And I'm a pussy. I just wanted to say it.
Right.
And write songs.
How does that affect your creativity flow when you're kind of on that treadmill trying to keep up with that kind of, artist life?
Oh, it's hard. It's next to impossible.
Yeah.
Especially country records, everybody was putting out a record every year.
Hmm.
And you can't do that if you're going to be the writer.
Yeah.
Right.
And some people can. I couldn't.
Yeah.
I needed a whole lot more settledness, and that's how I work best.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some people can pull it off, but I guess I need you know, my home life. I'm very much a homebody.
Sure.
And once I'm feeling good and comfortable, I'm all there.
Right.
You know, I'm ready to go.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
I don't need anybody to break my heart.
Well, that was a good title.
I want to write that one down. That's pretty good. Well, in 1997, you hit a career milestone when you won CMA Song of the Year Award for Strawberry Wine. It was a number one hit for Dana Carter the previous year, and you also earned your first Grammy nomination for Best Country Song as well, as and also with an ACM nomination for Song of the Year. I mean, that song was a crazy hit.
Like strawberry.
Tell us a bit about that song and just the experience of getting that kind of industry recognition.
That was quite a year. That was the year of complete, just out of the blue surprises. First of all, I wrote that song, it's a true story, about visiting my grandparents' farm in Wisconsin. My dad is a dairy farmer's son.
Right.
And that was just a huge part of my childhood. And, boy, I've gotten a lot of material just out of missing that in my life. And I had the title, and, you know, I thought it was going to be, you know, thinking about, like, yeah, when I got drunk and I threw up, you know, a teenager. But, you know, I told them the story, some of the stories, you know, and by the time we were through with it, it was like this little anthem. And we thought, this is cool. It's kind of art, you know. Nobody's going to cut it, but this is for us.
Yeah.
You know, some songwriters have that, okay, well, this is for us.
Yeah. Right.
And Pat pitched it around, and people kept passing on it. And We did this little showcase, I guess, for and invited some producers and some artists, and everybody played their new songs, and the only artist that showed up was Dina.
Huh.
And she put that little song in her pocket, and when she went back into the studio, it was available. So she recorded it, and it was incredible. And I'm a huge fan of her voice.
Yeah.
She was so different that I didn't think anything was going to happen, because she was so different.
Yeah.
And then she made that video, and I was like, whoa. I just kind of, you know, got this feeling.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from her. She was on the road doing a radio tour, and she said, I just called to tell you that Strawberry Wine is going to be the first single.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, by then we were friends.
Yeah.
And I was like, Dina, don't do it. Huh. No. It's a 5-minute long walk about losing your virginity.
Right.
That cannot be your first single.
Right.
And she said, I can't help. She couldn't help it. She was out there playing her song, you know, for these little radio get-together things, and that was the song everybody loved.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, really, radio picked it, which is, you know, that's a rare thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, then it was like, it started out a little slow.
Right.
And we were like, whoa. And then it just, at some point, it just exploded. I mean, I'd never, obviously, had an experience like that.
Hmm.
Where it's that, you know, it's almost a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was just a really fun year.
Yeah, but
it was a really fun, wacko surprise year.
Well, the hits kept on coming, including another number one with Dina Carter, We Danced Anyway, another Trisha Yearwood hit Everybody Knows, and a duet by Clint Black and Martina McBride called Still Holding On.
But I'll go on with me.
Still Holding On is a song you wrote with Clint Black and Marty Stewart, who were two very commercially successful artists at that time. How is it different writing with behind-the-scenes songwriters versus writing with kind of the high-profile artist writers?
Well, when it's a really high-profile artist, you never know what you're going to get.
Right.
You just kind of have to find a place to latch on.
Yeah.
And Clint came to the house, and we started writing, and we kind of got hung up, and we went and had lunch, and he moved here, and he moved to Hendersonville.
Right.
Because he assumed all the country stars lived there.
They did at one time.
Another generation of right. country stars did live there. And I live over kind of between Green Hills and Bellmead. And
right.
So we were killing, I was driving around, you know, showing him around this part of town, and he was fascinated with it. He was like, oh,
right.
I like this.
Right.
And this is closer.
Yeah.
And then we came back to the house and, you know, kind of finished it, but it needed a bridge, and we kind of just, and he had to go because he had something else. You know, they always have something they have to do.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so I didn't think anything of it. I thought, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know if that went well or not. And he called me the next day. And apparently, he went to Marty Stewart's to party.
Right.
And they wrote the bridge.
Right.
Wow. That's awesome.
And that was, you know, yeah. I was like, wow, that's okay.
Seems like a lot of your songs are written at parties.
Right. And my biggest hits are booze songs.
There right, there's a theme. There's a theme. So you and Marty and Clint never actually all three got together in one room.
No.
And, well, that's funny.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, me and Marty have, you know, in a separate setting, but no.
Right.
And I never wrote with Clint again, really.
Interesting.
Well, you had seen, obviously, an incredible string of hits throughout the 90s, and you closed out that decade with the Dixie Chicks recording of If I Fall, You're Going Down With Me, another big hit.
Hey, gotta hold on. If I fall, you're going down with me. You're going down with me, baby, if I fall. I can't stay back, baby, little sugar, get me. You're going down with me, baby, heart and all.
Tell us about that one.
What a title for that time in their career. That was
foreshadowing.
They had flipped the last hit in.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. That was just a fun song.
Yeah.
I wrote with Annie Roloff. You know, it's just a title I had. It was super easy. You know, it's kind of like Memphis, you know, it's just real easy. And I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
And then Dixie Chicks said it, and then they released it, and that was a score.
Yeah,
it was a score for me because I really wanted a Dixie Chicks cut. I loved them.
Sure,
yeah. Still do.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the hits kept coming as we move into the 2000s. You know, we got songs like Faith Hill's You're Still Here, Patti Loveless's On Your Way Home, and then we also find Gretchen Wilson's I Don't Feel Like Loving You Today. And that song didn't chart as high as some of the other ones, but was nominated for a Best Country Song Grammy. And it's got such a classic country feel. How did that song come together?
It was kind of a cool thing. And I don't want to sound too, like, you know, out there, but that title just popped in my head, and I swear I felt Harlan Howard in the car.
Huh.
Because Harlan was like an uncle to me. I mean, we were pretty tight.
Yeah.
And I just when it was hard. It was hard when he was gone.
Yeah.
For me. And I just felt him. I swear I felt him in the car.
Wow.
Wow.
I even thanked him, and I wrote it down on the back of a checkbook, and I was scheduled to write with Jim Collins, and kind of hit him with this sort of country thing, and it was one of those things that just kind of fell out.
Yeah.
Just one of those little gifts that just fall out. Right. And we look at each other and go, okay, not even much time. it's so funny. I told Pat after they, I always pictured this big country, you know, sounding track.
Right.
But, you know, they got the work tape, and they pretty much kept it like that.
Wow,
right.
And, you know, the production was very cool, but it was very sparse.
Yeah.
And radio just did not latch onto that. And,
right.
You know, I kind of feel like if they'd done a little bit more of a wowza production,
mm-hmm.
it might have gotten higher in the charts. But how cool just to be nominated on a not hit song.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, in 2011, you were nominated for your third Best Country Song Grammy, as well as for CMA Song of the Year for You and Tequila, which was a hit duet for Kenny Chesney and Grace Potter. And that's a song that you wrote with Dina Carter that appeared on her 2003 album, I'm Just a Girl. But it's also on your 2011 album, The Dreaming Fields.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because we were actually listening to your version before we started talking today. We were listening to your version on The Dreaming Fields as compared to Kenny's version. And they're both great records, but they're both very different records. I mean, yours to me, I mean, honestly, I like yours a lot better because it's just organic and it's rootsy, and you can hear like the sound of, you know, even in the intro, you can hear the hands on the guitar. Like it sounds like music that is being made by people. You know, it's not it's not slick. It's just immediate. And you know, I love that kind of production style. But I bring that up not to bag on Kenny's version.
Yeah, thanks,
I
mean, man. We just lost Chesney and everybody in his circle now.
Right. I mean, it's great, you know, for what it is. It's you know, his record's
Kenny,
great too.
Kenny recorded it as a hit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but that sort of leads me to a broader question. When you know, when you are a songwriter and you're writing a song, you're probably often gonna have a sense in your head of, this is what this song sounds like or is going to sound like as a record. And then you kind of release it out into the wild and your publisher is pitching it. You don't know who's going to cut it. You don't know who's going to be producing. How do you kind of let go as a writer to kind of say, hey, somebody might interpret my song or produce my song in a very different way than I ever imagined it. And sometimes that might be to great effect and you're thrilled, and other times you might kind of go, I don't know. But how do you kind of navigate the emotionality of releasing, you know, your creations into the wild to let people do with them as they please?
Well, one thing that I have told my publisher, Pat Hagen, don't put me in the room with the artist and the producer anymore to hear it for the first time.
Huh.
Because I do not have poker face. And there's always an adjustment period.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're going to phrase the way they phrase. They're going to. And with You and Tequila, this is going back to Kim Kreckel again.
Right.
Cindy, a foreman over at Universal, asked me if I'd ever considered pitching it to a guy. And I said I had not. And she said, do you think you could get a male vocal on it? And I was writing with Tim Kreckel. And, you know, I don't use demo singers very often.
Right.
Because they don't do it. Some of, you know, it's hard to find one that really gets you going. Yeah.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I asked him to do a guitar vocal with me, and so we went downstairs, and me and him played and sang, and that was that, and it was pretty close to how Tim was playing it on guitar, because Tim didn't, you know, the way I play it on guitar, that's just not his style. He's
right.
More muscular, and but the he sprays it differently. And Kenny is closer to what Crackle did. That's the version Kenny heard.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I was pretty happy about that one.
Yeah, big hit.
I would be.
Plus, it had been a few years. I was like, okay, this is where I'm. They put the old cow out to pasture. I was happy.
Well, I want to ask you about a song that that was not a hit, but one that I think is really great. The Dreaming Fields album includes a song called "Your Husband's Cheating on Us," which is worth the price of admission for the title alone.
Do you mind if I come in and only take a minute or two? By the way, I really like what you've done to this place. Doesn't really surprise me, hon. We kind of have the same taste. That's enough small talk. Something we need to discuss. Your husband's cheating on us.
Tell us about that one.
Oh, that was an assignment. a college professor at UNC had adapted some work of mine and Marshall Chapman's music and Lee Smith and Joe McCorkle's work, they're novelists.
Right.
And it was a play, it was, the concept was mine, and the rest was just serendipitous, you know, just, it all just kind of fell into place. But I wrote the song called Bill Girls with Randy Scruggs,
mm-hmm.
and people really loved that. Off of my Rising Tide record.
Right.
And I thought, I would love to do have a Southern play or musical or something about that. And so this professor puts it together, and it's a big hit, you know, kind of regionally. And then they took it to Off-Broadway, and the director wanted it a couple more songs.
Right.
And so me and Marshall just kind of poured through Jill and Lee's books, you know, just to see if we could find something.
Right.
Because it was, all our stuff was sort of randomly placed together, and we thought it would be cool if we could actually really bind the two.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was the title of a short story of Jill. Your husband's cheating on us. And we basically just wrote a song around the story. We borrowed so much from the story that we gave her a third writer.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's cool.
Well, in 2008, you were inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame at the age of 44. And at the most recent ACM Awards, you were honored with the Poets Award, which has previously been given to Merle Haggard, Holland Howard, Cindy Walker, Tom T. Hall, Chris Christopherson, Willie Nelson, and others. I mean, that's a serious list of people to be in the conversation with. You know, these are honors that you probably only dreamed of when you were starting out. But I want to ask you, how does recognition like that kind of land on you? Does it feel like a sense of relief, like, oh, my work is being appreciated? Or does it land like a kind of pressure, like, oh, now my work has to live up to this new title that I've got?
No, I never feel that kind of pressure. I just feel so grateful. And so filled with wonder.
Mm.
I can't believe this has happened, you know?
Right.
I just, every single Grammy nomination, every single CMA nomination, every single, the Hall of Fame, and it's stuff that I didn't dare dream.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
I was like, I just want to write some hit songs, you know? And I love writing songs, and I really love it when they're hits.
Yeah, right.
And, and I love making records that they'll leave me alone.
Yeah.
And it's just, this is like stuff that, it just shocks me every time. I'm getting choked up talking about it.
Yeah.
It's just a wondrous feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's so many great Matresa Berg songs that have been hits for so many different artists. And to me, there's nothing like hearing you do your own songs in these, you know, last couple records that you've done. Like you say, you love doing them if they leave you alone, and I think they need to leave you alone because you know what you're doing. And hearing you deliver your own songs is really special. So we thank you for, you know, the great music and the great hits and the great legacy and the way you've sort of maintained that tie to Nashville's traditions while also, you know, doing it in your own voice, in your own way. It's very inspiring. So we just appreciate you spending some time with us today and giving us a little insight and stories behind your songs and career.
Oh, thanks a lot. Good talking to you.
Thanks, as always, for listening and for your support.
We'd love to stay connected with you, so please sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Again, you can find us by searching for Songcraft Show, all one word. While Songcraft is available to our listeners at no charge, we ask friends like you to consider becoming a Songcraft patron at patreon.com/songcraftshow. That's patreon.com/songcraftshow. There you can pledge as little as $2 per month to help Songcraft continue its mission of bringing you great interviews with great songwriters. Plus, you'll have the opportunity to access bonus content and get the chance to enjoy unique rewards and experiences as a member.
We look forward to getting together again with you for the next episode of Songcraft, Spotlight on Songwriters.